All right, welcome back to the Beit Midrash.
Thank you for shifting. I need this light versus that one that's out, because I just don't have enough. My rods and cones aren't exercising, and therefore they need a little help. So I'm having trouble over here. I'm realizing what trouble and I means. So anyway, we're going to go back 82. Let's start just to get back into things by going to 82a2 in the Gemara.
82a2?
Yeah, 82a2, the Mishnah, at the Mishnah. So we're into a different Mishnah. What we're going to do today is we're going to talk about the sick person who feels like he must have something to eat. We're going to, that's after we remind ourselves about the humanity and the prescription of what happens with a pregnant woman and with a sick person who needs to eat. We're going to look at some sources about what it means to have experts around, doctors, and the person making some decisions for himself. Talk a little bit more about that again. And then we'll do another Mishnah that brings up a concept of being ravenous and ask about whether or not it's having a certain kind of disease. Whether the Mishnah seems to be defining a disease, we know. We'll get a little help. And we'll also look at a book we've mentioned often, but I've never really read from directly, and I'll share with you what's in Julius Proust's Biblical and Talmudic Medicine, translated by Fred Rossner, which we've mentioned in the context of this learning.
Good friend, Fred.
And Fred is a good friend, so... Yeah. We'll say, Fred, you're here. The kavod, with respect to you. And do you know him from years ago?
I've known him for many, many, many years. I don't know if he's still alive, but it's actually an interesting story. He was a camp doctor, and he trained at Maimonides Hospital. Mm-hmm. So we got fascinated with Maimonides and started to become real.
Oh, that's why so often he'll go to the Maimonides after the Talmud and the Mishnah and the Bible.
And every summer, you know, he was a doctor during the year, it's academic.
Mm-hmm.
But every summer when he would be the camp doctor, he would write more about Maimonides and, mm-hmm. in particular, medical bioethics and history.
Hmm.
So he developed two careers.
We will be the beneficiaries for that camp, inspiring him to take on Rambam. And, of course, I imagine you shared your love of Yiddishkeit and Judaism and medicine.
Yeah, and he was a great role model for a lot of people.
That's great. So he did this great work translating and adding to Julius Proust's work on biblical and Talmudic medicine. And we'll get to there. Okay, starting, though, with this Mishnah again. If a pregnant woman smelled food or drink and craved it on Yom Kippur, right? So we were surprised to hear, but we weren't so surprised to hear. We feed her until she feels relieved. So we see the humanity in the sources about the pregnant woman, and then we see chole, a sick person. You feed him al pi viki'in. On the advice of experts. So who were these experts? We asked. Why did it say Biki'in and not Rofim? We said maybe the word Rofe was not used as often, Meir brought up, you know, linguistically. Maybe Biki'in was their code for doctors. Maybe we needed those already specialists we didn't mention last time. Were there specialists in what was going on with the Cholim at that time? We don't know. Or was it at least the most learned of those people within a town or a city? Mm-hmm. Because you might not be in a place where there were recognized healers, per se. So we have all kinds of possibilities. V'im ein sham b'ki'in, because they say there might not be any experts present. Machilin oto al pi atzmo. You feed him according to his own assessment. Ad sheyomar dai, until he says enough, enough. Because when Jews start feeding, I guess...
This looks to me like the first reference to a second opinion.
Right. So I just
the fact that it's in the plural.
That's right. So you really do have that. I don't know what day it was for Minyan, but I said that from this week's Parsha, Mishpatim, is when you have the first Torah that suggests a second opinion. I went to a doctor's office once in Israel. I was just arrived. That was on Monday, right?
Yeah, I mentioned that.
So I went to the doctor. I was having a little bit of issue. And it was a new whole framework for me medically. It was now the Israeli system. I walked in. You know, people very serious about medicine in Israel, thank God, so you don't have to worry so much. But I walked in and I saw, even at the doctor, I could learn Torah. Because on the wall is a poster that highlighted these two words in this week's parasha, which says, Rapo Yerape, thou shalt surely heal. Now, it's in the context of paying for medical payments that you might owe somebody because someone was injured.
Right.
But underneath that, in English, it said, get a second opinion, because I'm not God, Dr. So-and-so. And what's fascinating about it is that from that, Rapo Yerape, you have people that say the duplication of the verb, because we always learn something when verbs are you know, double down verbs, emphatic forms of the verb, that you can learn something. And what do you learn from Rapo Yerape? Surely you will go to the doctor. No, surely you will go to the doctor and then go to another one to get a second opinion, right? So that's where it comes from.
So when you say Adonai, Adonai, you need to look for another God.
Ron, you're always extending the logic. You're always extending Talmudic logic shall be applied non-uniformly. Didn't you learn that? Okay, it's true that if you take things out to their logical extremes, sometimes you have to say, but not in that case. our Olpan teachers would say, here are the rules for Hebrew, Bederech Klal.
Yotzei Min HaKlal.
Bederech Klal. Because there are Yotzei Min HaKlal. Right?
Like
everything is natural, and Bederech Klal. Generally, it works that way, until Yotzei Min HaKlal, until one takes off and goes the other direction. All right, so my point to go back through here is not that we're going to start with all the sources, the text right after that, because that's what we read last week. We saw that we really can feed her even non-sacrificial meat, even treif, right? That we had to do this, and that it's very, very much a human text. We aren't cooking in our own kitchens, but people around us are. We made the point that sociologically we saw where the Jews are living. Some Jews, at least, are living in places where it's not just all Jewish quarters or right there. They had to walk through potentially all kinds of neighborhoods. Marketplace cities for sure, or towns, had a dynamic kind of reality even back in that time. But what I wanted to do is pick up on page 82B now. So turn to 82B. And you see that there's only one page of 82B. And I want to talk about, because remember that we talked about three mitzvot that you have to keep and not worry that you're giving up your life. In other words, you have to pay with your life if you're asked to transgress three mitzvot. Right? Do you remember what they were? They were murder, incest, adultery, some kind of sexual transgression that is improper,
idol worship.
So that's where we are. The Gemara at this point, in the midst of the Yoma discussion, brought up the central ethical principle introduced, or let's say also shared in parallel in Sanhedrin. Over there, doing it in the context of serious kinds of questions about whether or not you can kill in self-defense, and whether or not the court should adjudicate one way or another, and what's the midrash that Sanhedrin brought up to say that you should in general try to save life even if you're asked to transgress something. The verse was v'chai behem. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, we mentioned, took this small phrase and said live through them, live by them. Therefore, generally we say God desires life, and because God so desires life, if you were to be asked to transgress something, you know, eat this pound of hazer, eat this pound of pork, or pay with your life, you eat the pound of pork.
Haven't I heard of martyrs who would not?
For sure you've heard of martyrs. We spoke a little bit about the notion that martyrdom, in the sense of for not worshiping their gods for sure was part of the culture in Talmudic times, medieval times. But martyrdom for something other than those three, we don't really hear a lot about. So we hear about martyrdom in the context of these three, what we call cardinal transgressions. We would never transgress, we would never sin breaking these three. And we would even pay for them with our lives. But the others, in general, are seen as breakable for the sake of life. But these three are not. And I want to get to the Maaseh that's included in the Gemara on 82b in our Gemara in Yoma, where these are being discussed in the context of Yom Kippur, in the context of living an ethical life, in the context of living a life where we are talking about sins and transgressions, the Yom Kippur framework of discussing these laws. And I'll show you which Maaseh they bring forward in terms of the killing. So having stated that one must sacrifice his life rather than commit murder, the Gemara presents the source for the law. V'rotzeach gufei minalan. From where do we know that the law is really this law that one cannot murder and one should pay with one's life even? Svarahi, it's based on an approach that we call svarah, on logic, on reasoning, on learning out the mitzvah. Deha hu de'ata lekamei de'rava, amarle, as in this case of a certain individual who came before Rava and said to him, amarli madri dudrai, the governor of my town said to me, katle liflanya, kill so-and-so. Flanya here is the fancy plony that we sometimes meet. Mm-hmm. Like you've heard the John Doe or Jane Doe, yeah, of Judaism is
kill so-and-so.
Plony,
yeah.
Almoni.
Right?
John Doe.
Plony
Almoni. Okay? Jane Doe. Plonit Almonit. Here, the fancy name, Liflanya, like Mishu, someone.
Right.
Liflanya. So kill so-and-so. V'i lo katil nalach, and if you don't kill him, I'll kill you. Amarle, Rava says to him, niktalach, let him kill you. The lo tiktol, and do not kill, do not transgress. My chazit, what do you see? The damadidach, to assume that your blood sumaktafe is redder than his.
Right.
How could you possibly say that yours is more worthy of his? So despite the fact that God seeks to preserve life and wants us to observe mitzvot so that we add life and experience life, given that the other person's sentence is already decided by this head of city, this mayor of the town, and it's death, you can't now say, well, my death is either preferred or my death is worse for the world than his. Because in the end, you don't know. And that is a value orientation about life that doesn't get a lot of Gemara. You might have expected someone to say, oh, wait a minute, on the measurement that you can't tell someone's life, it's blood, is red, or he's already dead because he's some criminal, because he's already sentenced to death by the court of heaven, because he's not a person who pays back his debts. Give me any situation. There's not a lot of machloket in the places, at least in the Gemara, where this value statement is brought forward. Right? You might have expected, based on rabbinic kind of approaches to ethics, that someone could say, well, Let's just take a look at that. Can you say that preserving your own life is more important, thusly, do the job? But because it's the action of your needing to be the killer, and you're not the one who is allowed to at that moment in any framework of mitzvah, allowed to use lethal force, then your blood is no redder than his blood is no redder than yours. Now, are there times when we have permission to use lethal force? That's a different question. You have a milchemet reshut, a war that's permissible. You have rodef, which we brought up the last time. You're chasing someone who is chasing another person to kill them, and you kill them. It's self-defense, as if the person was trying to attack you. There might be other occasions where lethal force, someone tunnels in at night. We see in the Torah that there are cases. But in this case, you have to understand that it's a value statement. It's a question of ethics, equating life and life, and therefore you can't decide that the sentence is done, I'll kill him, and my life being more important, my blood redder, should convince the heavenly court that I'm in the right. I have to give my life.
I was just going to say that I'm surprised that that is the rationale for the conclusion, that it's a comparative comparison of whose life might be worth more.
Mm-hmm. Why does this surprise you?
I would just think, I'm wrestling with that, but I would just think that there are other grounds just on the basis of not taking a life that isn't in self-defense or one of the other kinds of...
Like, why didn't they just say, thou shalt not kill?
Right. Why didn't they just say, thou shalt not kill? There are exceptions to that if your life is threatened, et cetera, et cetera. But why would they go to say, if you're doing this, you're judging your life versus their life? You know, there's an indirect threat on your... I mean, it's a threat on your life if you don't take that life.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just surprised at the rationale for...
Anybody have a direct response to why this might be the rationale?
I think he has a point, because don't we have a saying, Chayecha kodmim v'chayecha v'recha? Don't we have that somewhere in the context of maybe two people in the desert and one
right, and one
water?
One
something
water.
Like that?
Yeah, but
it's always...
That's a different scenario. This is a scenario of this,
no,
this
it is.
Governor of the town
scenario.
Or leader.
My
of,
death or your death, that's what it is.
So they want to make a distinction in Jewish ethics between that story and this story.
They
want to say that's really a different case, because here you're being asked to kill somebody, and there you're being asked to deal with the water that you've got and
I'm
think
still
about.
Being asked to kill someone because the other person is going
no
to
die.
No
one's ever specifically asking in that story. It's kind of like a cross-examination. Are you telling me that deciding who's going to drink the water is the same as the governor saying, kill that person over there?
So
if you would
persons.
Say, well, I'm saying that metaphorically, but...
So the third person, there's three parties, not two. There's the governor.
There's the forcible commandment.
Okay.
By the way, this forcible commandment is legal?
According to which authority?
According to the story.
According to the story, that's what happened.
No, but if it's legal, maybe the governor has no legal right to...
No one here, let's say, asked whether or not there's any legality, a question of judicial process or the like, about the decision of this guy to say, kill so-and-so. It's assumed that that's what the situation is.
I was just wondering, are there other places where there are scant resources... And then they do say, well, this person is young or whatever. So are there other discussions of that, and they come to different conclusions about the value of lives when they're...
Well, let's say that we wanted to get even onto the same scenario, further into the triage that you're suggesting comes in an ethical sort of dessert, as in dessert being deserving of something, a dessert kind of discussion. So there are times... when the tradition is going to grapple with, even in the scenario of someone being given over to be killed, how exactly it will work if the authorities come and say, you're a group of 20 in there, send out one, we'll kill the one and we won't kill all of you. Versus if they have a warrant and a penalty to apply to Plony Almoni, and they say, we know you've got Plony Almoni in there, send out Plony Almoni who's got a death sentence, and the rest of you will live. Otherwise, we're killing all of you. And in that scenario, if they've named someone, you can hand over the person. But in the scenario where you have to make a random decision, then you really are not allowed to hand over anyone else, because is your blood really redder than anybody else's? In other words, if you are looking to save your own skin, what makes you the one to be saved?
Yeah, so I'll come back to why I don't like the standard from a sort of judicial basis, but I think it's interesting because I think the Rofe, if you take this as the general principle, then the Rofe, you could fit into this philosophical construct, because you could make the presumption that anybody who is about to kill someone else in God's eyes is someone who's less worthy than you, and therefore is or less worthy than the one he's about to kill, because he's the killer, and therefore he fits under this rubric that if we're in a situation where somebody's going to die, then under these circumstances it's clear that this person is the least worthy among the three people involved.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's interesting that you don't have to set the Rofe off to the side if you accept
the Rodef?
Right.
Okay.
Sorry. So you don't have to create a separate category for that that would fit under this. So now, mm-hmm. having said that, this invites really terrible things, because it would imply that under certain circumstances, let's say that he says to kill someone who is a known criminal. In that circumstance, it would be clear that, assuming the person he's telling it to is an upright citizen, presumably God weighing the sins of the individuals, you would have a case to make that his blood is redder. And that would be a really that's why I don't like this as a judicial principle, because I think that it opens up Pandora's box for people sitting in God's stead saying, well, it's very obvious whose blood is redder, and therefore under these circumstances it's quite fine to go ahead. I'm very troubled by it, those are just the observations I'd make.
Listen, here's what Rashi says, just to relate to a little bit of what you're bringing forward, and Richard, the initial question. Rashi explains Rava's reasoning as follows. Okay, the verse Chai Behem, live by them, and you shall live by them, teaches that life is more precious to God than observance of his laws. Thus, if someone is given an ultimatum, transgress a Torah prohibition or I will kill you, God prefers that he transgress the prohibition so that life will be saved. However, that's what he says in the Ivrit. However, if once told, murder that person or I will kill you, someone will die in any event, whether it's the intended murderer or the intended victim. In this case, the commission of the crime will not preserve life. Accordingly, there is no basis to remit the act unless one knows that God values his life more than that of the intended victim. Your blood is redder than his, right? So you're on to, if you know, and being very wary of that judicial standard, right? And hopefully you'd never have to get to the moment of adjudication and really understand this as an applied judicial principle. On the other hand, the statement that it exists might be a lesson for, let's say, legal philosophy versus actual judicial policy. And this, I think, it answers the question, like, why do you have this? Because if the principle is that no matter whose life we're talking about, even that convicted death row killer, and we're talking about a sense of blood and blood is life and the value of life in general, then the push is towards not maybe applying this principle in a judicial kind of way as a process orientation for your criminal procedure, your sentencing and your penalties, but it is to say that you should be very wary of putting force of death into the hands of the judiciary, and you should be wary of anyone who is asking you to become a killer for the state and having you be part of that system. And in a kind of theoretical way, again, the legal philosophical position about it all is to say, wow, of mitzvot that I have to work on affirming in my life, affirming the value of life becomes central to the project. By this being stated in Sanhedrin, by this being stated in Yoma, it could be that that legal philosophy, or that, let's say, spiritual philosophy that's introduced by this statement, is what's at stake in the greatest way, as opposed to any kind of adjudication of matters in the simple sense of the story.
If we now substitute war, we shoot deserters for not engaging in killing the enemy, which is exactly parallel.
Here's the question about war. And this is part of the questions about halachic systems, this is part of the question about legal systems in general. Something that is can be categorized as, let's say, separate and apart from civil society, like war and wartime and action in war and killing in war and a soldier's duty and obligation in the forces that wage war. Can they and should they have their own separate laws and halachot and applications of law, and what distinctions create the need for that versus, say, civil society, and how the Gemara would see the creation of such a system? So with war, of course, there's a whole set of law, and with human history, of course, this gets into broader conceptions of society than just Jewish society. When they conceive of war and have laws about whether it's an obligatory law or it's a permitted war, or defensive wars are the only ones that you'll be permitted, and what constitutes defensive law, and a soldier's obligation to that army, and traitors being hanged or killed for their treason, and deserters, as you're mentioning, being punished in whatever way they're to be punished. The larger question for the policymakers about those procedures and policies and laws in military court have to be some of the same legal philosophy questions that we'd ask after having gone through the Gemara. What's at stake here? How much shall we value life? Will we get to the place where we put the penalty into the code, and will we apply it? Will we kill soldiers who will ultimately desert, right? So an Israeli army may answer that question very differently than the Iraqi army, based on, again, the wisdom and the legal philosophy and the values orientation of texts and what informs the creation of those laws. You might start from the place where you wouldn't want any of those to be, how we ultimately use our chokmah and our organizational skills. But when we do, here's what we're going to apply. I think the Gemara stands with a check on reality in that way. And perhaps some other systems won't have as deep a statement in both the spiritual tractate and the legal tractate like we do. That's the brilliance, I think, of entering this philosophy.
So I'll just come back with just one comment. And so you could easily take this scenario and put it into war and say, in fact, this is what we do to all soldiers, essentially.
But soldiers usually know the rules and regulations before they deserve.
Okay.
So they're in the game.
Well, again, if you have a conscripted army or you have a volunteer army, it may be somewhat different. But I think really the point that I want to make is the point that Freud made after World War I. He wrote this this essay on thoughts of the times for on war and death. I think that's the correct title. But essentially, he said, "What's and of course the world was totally demoralized by the First World War, which was catastrophic." At every level. But what he said was, I think, incredibly insightful. And he said, what's so depressing to people about war is to recognize that the rules that the society makes for civil actions are not to outlaw bad actions, but to monopolize them for the government's purposes. Meaning that it can violate those laws in order to achieve its goals. So I just think it's really, even though it's off to the side, I think it's actually really important to see how societies operate under war, because I think they say a lot more about the society than how it operates under peaceful civil existence.
I'll only say that in Freud's noticing human nature, being cynical about the possibility of the nation state as a entity that as an entity that harnesses power and ultimately makes legal the transgressions of great moral systems. We might say that that's definitely part of the great critique of the project of nation statehood, and in terms of evolutionary biology, what systems need a fixing in the human plane of existence, right? So the more we notice it, I think the better off we are, and that's where I think the positive side of that Freudian observation really exists, right?
In evolutionary psychology, there is something called the trolley dilemma.
What dilemma?
Trolley. And there is a drunk on a bridge and a doctor on a
bridge. The train track.
And a train track.
Yeah.
So the drunk see two people walking on the track and he wanted to save them, so he saw the doctor to stop the train. Is it allowed? Did he do something right? And we can change it completely different. There is a doctor on a bridge and a drunk lying down there, and the doctor sees two people walking, or three people walking on the track, and he throws the drunk person to the track to stop the train. Is it allowed?
Yeah. I mean, this is moral philosophy in the making, right?
Right.
Kohlberg didn't have us standing on the tracks with the switch. In our hands. He had us at the pharmacy wondering whether or not someone who broke in and stole medication for someone that he loves, who couldn't afford it, could get the medication. These questions are we're not going to get to the ultimate right answer unless we create the great debate and have a group of people that vote for the moment of who made the better arguments tonight, right? But this is the same way that the Gemara is asking us, how are you going to make decisions, and when are you going to make decisions about who can be sentenced to death, whether or not you have the right to kill at any time, whether or not we're talking about the real possibility of this happening, or in the theoretical space of lawmaking, the nature of humanity, and the power that's exerted over in this case, over the rabbis, as they deal with the colonialization of their own land by the Roman authorities, let's say, if this is what's represented at all. And so I think that we have we've juiced this, right, for all the possibilities that it has and all the limitations that it has. And we have to just know that it's talking in general terms, in broad terms. I want to give you one other example, though, of how it could be for someone in a very strange way, a very real question. If Israel were to have had a death penalty system, which they don't.
They're talking about it now. Big problem.
But if they do, and I'm someone who works in the death penalty system, and I can see myself, even to the point of being the one who is to draw and plunge that syringe or apply the lethal force, or I work in the system and I really see this as part of my work, as we have in this country, many, many, on the levels of thousands of guards and prison officials who work in a death penalty system. This could face someone in a more pshat sense than we have asked about it in the grander, either legal, philosophical, or judicial, legal application kind of way that it exists here. And I find that to be also just really, it's pungent. It's so powerful.
That's why I don't like the redder.
I understand. I understand.
They could just easily assuage their
exactly, and there are those who would go that direction. I said they're not right here in the Gemara, but by the way, wouldn't you know, based on just how this is worded, right? I read you the footnote. Since one cannot possibly assume such a that God values his life more than that of the intended victim. Well, aren't we going to necessarily get into this notion of the intended victim and who really is this intended victim? And if I'm a death worker, and I've dehumanized that soul even beyond the level of just thinking about whether or not he has any dessert left in his life, what kind of tragedy that is for a system. So death work is an area that's examined very specifically already back from the late 70s and into the 80s by a fantastic thinker named Robert Johnson. He has at least two books. Maybe a third is about the whole system without being about the workers themselves. But he did more interviews of death sentence, death penalty workers. Death Work was the title of his book. And he interviewed folks who were in this system and how deep, deep dehumanization occurs within this system, not of the victims or the those sentenced to death, but of the workers and of the system itself and what kind of expression that makes, quote-unquote, on the face of the earth when it comes to this kind of question. How do we start thinking about, you know, the one life and its ultimate value versus another? You know, penalization, incarceration, penalties, justice, all those questions aside about the specific work of the death sentence world, he did a deep investigation. It's fascinating reading, and it's very accessible, though it's very scholarly, if this is an area of interest.
Yeah, in that particular situation of the death worker, that even wouldn't be a question raised here. The answer would be quite clear. The death worker should not be killing, because the death worker's life is not even in question. He would get fired.
He would get fired.
He would get fired. But in this question, in this case, the dilemma here is who's, yeah, is he will, the I see from the commentary that you read that it makes more sense to say what it really saying is you could violate a prohibition to save a life. In this case, since a life will not be saved in doing this, then it's a question of why your life versus But in the death worker's case, it would be clear.
I don't have to be, with the death workers, so clear as to apply it exactly to say that's the case of this case. To be barbed about my being part of a system that functions in some way like this, right? And that, you know, whether or not I'm due a spiritual death because of my participation in this because I'm not valuing life, that's the kind of way I'm reading a little bit more expansively than just the scenario itself to answer that part of what you're saying. And yeah, I mean, I think that, again, figuring out when this applies and how it could apply and drive us forward is really the essential question the Gemara is asking, especially in Yoma. And that's my point back to our reading this with ritual lens and the day of Yom Kippur, this being included. It's not about the adjudications, it's not about the judges, it's not about exact policy like we have in Sanhedrin. I think it's included here for this kind of discussion. Can we read on?
Yeah, about the color of red, of blood.
No, because we're done with that.
There is a very important issue in the Talmud. Because if there is an avalanche on Friday,
we're going to get to the next Mishnah.
You answered me.
Yeah, the next Mishnah. So wait about that. Okay, let's get there. Yeah, it's in the next Mishnah. Ron's making mention of a case where we have a life to potentially save, and how.
And it's the color of red.
Right, and it's the color red. And so we say that because people's blood is red and life is such a value, we go and save them. Right? That's the point, and it will be made, and that's the equal and opposite side of this very policy itself. So, exactly. Well, before you get there in the Gemara, interestingly enough, it's going to now go back and say, what about this pregnant woman again? Let's look at what it says. There was a certain pregnant woman, Hahi Ubara de Orcha, Atulakame de Rabbi. They came before Rebbe and asked him what to do about this pregnant woman, obviously being what? Very hungry. Atu l'kame de Rebbe. Amru l'hud. Rebbe said to them, Zilu lo chashula de yomach dichipurehu. Go and whisper to her that it's Yom Kippur. Right? As if she didn't know. L'chushula v'ilachisha. They whispered to her, and she accepted their whisper. Ah, it's Yom Kippur, yeah. Now, what's the point? I think you may be able to read this and take 2 points away from it at least. One is, they whispered to her, and she was kind of reminded that she had to really ask herself, do I really need this, or can I hold out? Because he was of the mindset that maybe that's the right approach, Rebbe. And two, they whispered to her to do it because, and the Gemara might be prodding us to think this way, they whispered to her to do it because there's something admirable about taking this spiritual work really importantly, even in the face of some physical discomfort. And by the way, since it's in the context of the Mishnah with Biki'in, with experts concerning the sick person, that you could either understand or assume or imagine that there are some Biki'in around and we're talking safe enough. We're talking safe enough. Well, that's the question. So what is it about whisper? Whisper as a dimension, right? You don't want to embarrass her, and it's very personal. Remember, because the Mishnah also, in the context of the Chole, says it's about his determination, right? So with her too, it is about her determination. All these hints make me know that I can read this generously, versus being suspect of Rebbe, who simply wants this pregnant woman to maintain the fast, because that's what we do on Yom Kippur.
It gives her the option.
So I'm reading it in that general sense, in that generous sense.
The whisper, just the reminder, just that she really wanted.
Yeah. So Kare Ale, Rebbe applied the following verse to the fetus, Beterem etzacha babeten yidaticha. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. before you left the womb, I sanctified you. Nafak mina, Rabbi Yochanan. And because she was such a tzaddeket, when it came to accepting her fast upon herself, who was born to her? Rabbi Yochanan. Now you see what a good fast on Yom Kippur might get you?
So only because of one woman we can eat on Yom Kippur?
No, only because one woman, we have Rabbi Yochanan in the world.
Shamu
Belet, I mean. One woman who didn't eat.
One woman who didn't eat.
So we're supposed to think that if you don't eat, you have a more righteous child, you have a better child. I mean, it's a kind of a...
I think what it said is that there's great reward in it. I have to imagine that there would be those who would take it very literally. I have to imagine that there could be other people who would see it as a general kind of encouragement for gaining the spiritual reward of fasting, not necessarily having to take it so literally.
Because I thought the end would be the one that was still hungry. Doesn't it say the one that was still hungry, and we gave her, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the Mishnah. But in this case, it's celebrating the rethinking, the woman rethinking, the notion that maybe you still want to do this, ought to do this.
The reward of the mitzvah.
And the reward of the mitzvah.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Pushing back. And it could simply be that obviously Rabbi Yochanan had a very observant mother, a very conscientious mother about observing. And this is passed down at the dinner table and every place else.
Right. Right. Do you know my mother suffered through pregnancy on Yom Kippur? You think she made him remember?
Yeah, she never let him
Would
forget that.
Would a mother that. Do that? Would a mother do that?
Never let him forget that.
Sometimes there are stories that are passed on. I think it's quite a nice story. The reason why I think it's a nice story is because it's got that whisper.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was about knowing that the Mishnah says to do it. Contrast that to the story we had about the sages and their children. Remember a few pages back when he didn't want to feed his kid on Yom Kippur and they nearly excommunicate him? Because it's a mitzvah for you to fast, but you must feed your children. And we saw that, again, feeding children was the first law in the Tosefta, the parallel to the Mishnah, even though they didn't say it explicitly in our Mishnah until the last Mishnah, after the initial one. So we had it in both places, the Mishnah and the Tosefta, to make sure that we did what was right by our family. Okay. Hahi ubara. And there was another pregnant woman who smelled food, obviously, and needed it, craved it. Ah, to the Kamei de Rabbi Hanina. It's right on the right side of 82B still. And they came before Rabbi Hanina and asked him what to do. Amar lahu, he said to them, Lachoshula, whispered to her that it's Yom Kippur. Velo ilchisha. They whispered to her, but she did not accept the whisper. The craving continued. Kare alei, and then Rabbi Hanina applied the following verse to the fetus. Oh, here's someone who really wants to dig in. Zoru rishaim merachem. The wicked are estranged from the womb. Nafak mina shab tayatzar perei. And indeed, Shabsi, the hoarder of produce, issued from her. The market manipulator. Now, right, so you see that there are some differences in approach, differences of opinion, and someone can be really hurtful in their being overly, overly frumy, overly, overly insistent that she do the mitzvah, right? How do we know that the Gemara is putting its own barb in and answering what I think is Rebbe's compassion and his approach? Here's my theory. Because take his name, and it's not just Chen, it's Hanina. They say, here's this rabbi whose name is all grace and mercy. And then, when he says, whisper to her, he says, look what evil comes from her womb. Right? Not such grace and mercy. Right? His name implies that he's going to be
this guy
full of chen.
The same way Shabtai implies the...
Right, same way, and that's the next element of it.
Very much so.
And so the notion that the person who's named here, Shabtai, Atzar Peire, I mean, how beautiful is fruit, and how wonderful the name Shabtai with Shabbat in it. And all, but it's really, I think, saying this is
not Shabbat. Shabtai is here is the...
Shabtai.
Well, okay, I'm going to skip that.
Okay.
That's another decision.
So what else? What else do you hear?
It's half of what I can say. I'll say only half. And that is the Shabtai is the name of the planet Saturn. And the planet Saturn was always associated with evil and stinginess and all the bad things that happen in life. So given this name here is not a coincidence. Because it starts with Zoro Rasha'im. The word is Rasha'im. And Shabtai is associated with evil throughout history, throughout mystical studies, always.
Interesting.
The connection with Shabbat by itself is separate, but there is a connection with Shabbat, but that's another discussion.
Okay, I'll tell you something interesting. So Shabbatai is Saturn?
There is Shabbat is there also.
View that they have not eliminated and that they have put in, because it is in there as another point of view in the last one. Doesn't seem to me as though it is omitting it or saying bad things about it.
Uh-huh.
They're finding very subtle things to mean that it is not valid.
The reason why I'm finding that is from the name that they're giving that Hanina, and the fact that they had the Rebbe story come before it. There's no doubt, Bobby, that you could that it could be, and you know that some of that attitude still persists.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying ignore it, but I am saying that sometimes the humanity that's within the entire narrative, right, starts with a Mishnah about being very humane towards a pregnant woman, starts with this Mishnah that's very much in response to her needs, response to the needs of the sick. And then all of a sudden you have one little opinion like that. It seems, yes, we could say it's in place because we know of it. But on the other hand, it's so out of place in the run of what's being said in this little stretch.
Remember, we started out by being surprised at how liberal they are.
Right.
So I think that it's no surprise that wasn't the universal opinion.
I was just going to say, though, that if we, and I'm sure people charted Rabbi Hanina's comments,
mm-hmm.
and if we charted Hanina's comments and put them all together, we would see whether this is really in character for Rabbi Hanina and
mm-hmm.
the kinds of things he does, or whether they're making the name to make something ironic about it. And if it's in character, then it's not the name, it's Rabbi Hanina's point of view.
Yeah, fair point. Okay. I won't mention that at least one great sage of the Talmud says that you can't rely on any collection of rabbinic statements by said rabbinic name to be any one real sage. But that would be heresy. So I'm not looking to get into that kind of... But that's a that's a great sage of the Talmud, as well as some of the others who would say, no, you really can profile these incredible people, and they're as dynamically human as you might think, with on the one hand saying it over on this case and being very extreme, and on the other hand having the saying we use to define all of the pursuit of justice in our lives in Judaism. So these are very dynamic people who come out looking...
Like Supreme Court judges.
Just look at them. All right, let's keep reading. I want to get to the next piece here, which is all about... a sick person who we feed on the advice of experts. Okay, so the Gemara says, "Cholim achlinoto al pi vikin." So you're going to feed a sick person on the advice of experts. The Gemara cites the Amareik ruling. Amar Rabbi Yanai. Rabbi Yanai says the following: Hole Omar Omer Tzarich. If the sick person says, I need to eat, the Rofe Omer Eino Tzarich. And the doctor says, no, he doesn't need to eat. Shom'im L'chole. You listen to the sick person, and you give him to eat. My Tama, what's the reason? Lev Yodei Amarat Nafsho. The heart knows the bitterness of the soul. The sick person himself is going to answer the claim, if you will, of this doctor through the wisdom literature. They're quoting Proverbs, that the heart knows the bitterness of the soul. Of course, think about the tensions that are brought up. Is it too retrojectory to read this section as being, like Barry said just a minute ago, didn't I see the first license for a second opinion in and around these parts? Is this the first place for patient bills of rights?
Actually, there's a big movement now that goes under the name of patient-reported outcomes.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, the FDA has now put into place that all new drugs should have in their development patient-reported outcomes. So separate from whether or not people live or die or whether or not the doctors think that a disease has been improved by a drug, there's an obligation to try to assess what the patient thinks. A very novel idea. And there's also been a big movement toward developing, for want of a better term, quality of life measures, meaning not only are there objective evidences of the patient improving, but does the patient actually, is that translating into the patient's quality of life improving, meaning their ability to take care of their hygienic needs, to mobilize, to do things that they enjoy in life. So I think that the Talmud is really way ahead here in this area of balancing the expert with the individual's perception of the outcome.
Really cool.
Of course, if one reads this and is aware of it, one would never ask the physician.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Why?
I think that a person could very well, as much as the person making a decision about eating something, could very well make a decision based on knowing what the experts think, and especially if,
especially
if there are two.
I'm saying the patient may ask the physician whether it's okay, but this is saying disregard the physician.
In this case, again, things are very atomistic. You have to see things as being case to case, right? So we won't apply things blanket. We're gonna see other cases. And let's look at what they say. So let's keep reading, and hold on to that. See if it satisfies your. Okay. So the Gemara says, "Pshita, it's obvious. Why was it necessary for Rabbi Yanni to say what he's teaching? And that is, if the sick person says, 'I need to eat,' etc. Mahu detema, you might have said, 'Rofe kimle tafe.' The doctor knows better than the patient, hence the patient shouldn't be allowed to eat. Kamash malan. Therefore, Rabbi Yanni informs us so right now that the patient in this scenario is going to be the one to listen to. But Rabbi Yanni continues with another law, and he has it like this: Rofe omer tzarich. If the doctor says he needs to eat, v'chole omer eino tzarich. But the sick person says, 'No, I don't need to eat.' Shomin l'rofe. We listen to the doctor. My tama. What's the reason? Tunbahu, dinakitle, perhaps delirium has seized him, and he's about to kill himself by eating this. So, in the same breath, we have to see here the wisdom of saying that the system also probably has some checks and balances, and we're working on them, as they did in this time. Sometimes we see that there's clarity, sometimes we feel there's real clarity, but if the doctor's there, let's say you've got 3-4 of the family members over here, and this guy says, "No, but I gotta eat. And the 3-4 family members hear what the doctor says, and if they feel like delirium has really set in, then you've got a law to rely on. And so you might say, well, wait a minute, how can you have a law like this, and how can you have a law like that? Because you need a law for the moment you need a law. Right? So there's a lot of richness to human reality in here, and there's a lot of what-ifs that we don't have answered because we don't have the cases necessarily described in all of their complexity, right? But we see that Rabbi Yannai knows both laws.
Yannai.
So, some people say Yannai, some people say Yannai.
I think if we were having this conversation 2 years ago, this wouldn't cross my mind, but now it's very much on my mind. The first thing is to recognize that they actually accepted the idea that there were experts, that there is such a thing as expertise.
Definitely.
That this is not just a, that the rabbis can make a judgment based on some other set of criteria. But
there were experts other than rabbis.
Right, that, exactly.
Yeah,
that,
for sure.
That, but I'm just saying, I said 2 years ago I would have taken that for granted. Now I think we have to be explicit about saying that the acceptance of expertise is actually a very fundamental aspect of this process. But there are limitations to the expertise.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not accepting the expertise with a whole swallow. There are conditions here in which the expertise is actually able to be overridden with a couple of understandings. Now, medically, again, we're back to evolution. Most people who have diseases that you wouldn't want to feed them usually are not very hungry. I mean, that's definitely what happens when people get diseases.
Say
that
again, diseases that you wouldn't want to feed them?
Right, so if I have acute appendicitis, right, in which case it might actually be not a great idea to feed me, I'm not going to be hungry. There's no question I'm not going to be hungry.
So the kind of disease, the kind of person who is sick and who wants food probably needs food.
So if somebody is, in fact, often the first sign that a patient is getting better is that their appetite comes back, that all of a sudden they're hungry. That's actually a great thing because it usually indicates that their bowel is working and, you know, so and other things are kicking in that they actually
have.
They need the energy. And obviously all of the things that have to go into homeostatic mechanisms to ensure that you have enough food for your energy output are back in shape. So there are some very fundamental, and those are driven obviously out of evolutionary consideration.
See how that all plays out in all the cases they bring, because I wonder if it's going to sound to you like there's this balancing act going on the acceptance of expertise and B, what they have right about disease and hunger, right?
But
that's going to be an interesting question here through the text.
If you put the two cases together, it seems to me that they are erring on the side that the pregnant woman should not eat, and they're erring on the side that the person that doesn't feel well should eat. They're giving two cases in which the person who doesn't feel well should eat, and they're giving a couple of cases where the woman who is pregnant should be reminded and rewarded with.
Interesting. It's an interesting read if you read those.
Yeah.
If you read those sources, again, we do often with what comes before, what comes after. Very interesting read, and maybe from experience, what they found was that it would obviously be the case that someone would be pretty hungry if you're pregnant, right? You're healthy, you're well, you're eating for two, as we say. Right, and with the other, if he says eat, we generally try to trust him unless total delirium is set in and we know by expertise that he shouldn't really do it, right? But by her, maybe we know from experience, again, experience has a lot to say about medical reality and how it unfolds, and this really is kind of patient experience, quality of life experience. Maybe we know from Yom Kippur's that pregnant women, they can do it if they have the strength to do it. And they're not going to completely become grabbed by this ravenous kind of sickness hunger that we notice also that's going to come.
Baby.
Yeah, or even harming the baby. In other words, maybe they know from experience that that's not the case. So, again, there is a way to look at it with, well, they didn't allow her to make the decision if we say that they're whispering to her, but here they're allowing him, what's the deal?
They're giving two instances right? Of which the answer is C.
Or those two instances were instances where it worked out pretty well, and at least one of the instances, because they had a real dialogue with her, the other more negative. Just depends on how you read it, but it can be read either way. Gemara challenges, though, Rabbi Yonai's rulings. Tanan. And it's going to come from a Tanaitic statement. Chole ma'achilin oto al pi vikiin. In the case of a sick person, we feed him on the advice of experts. Al pi vikiin in. On the advice of experts, yes. Al pi atzmo, lo. But on his own, by his own opinion, his own advice, no, we don't feed him. We have to have two vikiin. That's why it says in the Mishnah, vikiin. That's why this Tanaitic source says, by experts' advice. Al pi vikiin in. Further implies on the advice of experts, yes, plural vikiin. We feed him al pi vaki echad, but by one expert, no, we don't feed him on the expert of one. So you need the second opinion. You need the second opinion. Gemara answers by qualifying the Mishnah. Hacha b'mayaskina, no, let me tell you really what we're dealing with here. De'amar lo tzrichna, where the sick person said, I don't need to eat, and that is, he didn't have either the appetite or didn't kind of say, I absolutely want to eat. What do I need? I need to get Vicky'in in, and I need to have the Vicky'in tell me, yes, he better eat, and therefore he eats. Uluispule al pivaki. But even so, let us feed him on the advice of one expert then. If it's so important that he should eat, and you're going to have Bikin there, you're going to know it's so difficult to find two Bikin in this town, right? So let one guy come and say, let the Rope come in and say it. So why according to two experts, do we need the Mishnah, right? If you're concerned like that. Lo, tzricha. No, but we need it. We need it. Ve'ike acharina behadzei de'amar lo tzarich. Where there's another expert agreeing with the sick person who says that he doesn't need to eat. Ah, now we have, again, the patient involved in the medical care, so long as he's not, what, by this point? Delirious. And so we say that you bring in the second person so that the actual, like, decision here is not just, oh, well, this guy looks terrible, he's got to eat, obviously. You say, well, wait a minute, I have a reportage from the patient himself, and here's the situation. It seems to me he doesn't need to eat. Doesn't need to eat. So maybe it's because he's exhibiting some pain, and the experience of this second person was all about the pain. Barry just mentioned acute appendicitis. Maybe there's some reason why he really shouldn't. And by the way, in that time, you don't know who's Bucky and what. So you need to have a little chevruta. You need to have some conversation. That's what, at least we are, where we are at the Gemara at this point. Again, all this is still opening up. Machilino to'al pi vikin. But then the Mishnah is ruling, we feed him on the advice of experts. Shita, that's obvious. Sveik nefashotu. We say, if there's any doubt at all about the guy's life and his health, of course we feed him.
Okay, so medical question. I can't think. One day, 24 hours without food or drink is not really going to kill you, is it? In 99.9% of
people. Yeah, this is a good question to remind ourselves of.
No, I mean, sir, really.
No, I know. It's a good question.
You think it would, the way people carry on.
So Barry, what was the basic answer was 3 days without water.
No, which is just food. Assuming someone starts out healthy. Yeah. The answer is unequivocally yes. Right.
And even a baby in the womb is not going to suffer any lasting.
A much more complicated story, but I'm just saying there's no question that you can, again, if you start, it depends on how you're starting out.
Right, okay.
If there are certain circumstances where someone can get dehydrated very quickly, if it's very hot, if they're exerting themselves. I mean, you can create a scenario, and in fact, there are kids who die from heat stroke because they get dehydrated and they're exerting themselves, and so on and so forth. So but in general, an otherwise healthy person in 24 hours is not going to be in trouble.
And people do get sick on any given day, and they could get sick on Yom Kippur.
Well,
So that's why it needs to be evaluated.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely. And that work, by the way, go ahead, do that work. What these Mishnayot are also telling us is that that work needs to happen, you do that work, right? This isn't like second-tier stuff. This is first-tier stuff.
There was a case in the early time of the Israeli army, there was something called Mishmat Maim. In my time, we had Mishmat Maim. When we went on training or activities, we were not allowed to drink more than a certain amount of water through the day.
Because you couldn't have refilled. You couldn't refill.
We were a poor country, we didn't have water, and we couldn't carry water.
Mm-hmm.
It was very heavy. And a lot of kids, a lot of soldiers died because of Mishmat Maim. I think 7 or 10 years ago, they eliminated it. Now, you need to drink as much as you need, and there is no question.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Israelis died through the basic training and activities because there was Mishmat Maim.
Yeah, that's a different.
They didn't allow them to drink. I mean, they allowed them to drink, like, Two drops every 2 hours, whatever. You know, it's crazy. I'm telling you, it's crazy.
Right.
They eliminated it, and now it's okay. And since then, everyone is
I think
okay.
In the background to some of the text here, there's at least the worry or concern, not really having mass data in or all the experience in the world that's necessary to be acutely aware of this. I think there is some sense that there are certain kinds of either disorders or illnesses, and with a pregnant woman, real needs to actually feed someone and not let them go 24 or 25 hours without, right? On the other hand, we know it won't necessarily really negatively, you know, affect someone or kill the majority of people who could engage that fast. But there's a recognition here that you might really have to eat for some reason or another. And that's at the core of the project here, and that's even on Yom Kippur, right? And that's where we've been a little surprised at how far that goes, right? And so, does that answer the...
It's a good observation.
It's a good observation, because I think you're bringing up something we needed to remind ourselves again. There probably is the worry, or now expand on what we're recognizing. There is the worry that if they don't eat within this time period, they will suffer some kind of negative consequences, even though we know generally that a person can go for that amount of time.
No,
Harry?
It just broadens it into more modern times.
Well, it can, in that way, definitely.
That way, if you think about it.
So let's go to this next part. No, lo tzricha. I need still the notion of having these two experts come and say, right? It's not just fake nefeshot lahakel. It's not just there's a little bit of a danger here, so we're easy on the guy and we feed him, right? Lo tzricha, we need the teaching explicitly. Why do we need the teaching explicitly? Where there are two other experts agreeing with the sick person who say he doesn't need to eat. So wait a minute, now we've got four people in the family are doctors. Two, absolutely the guy needs to eat. Two, absolutely, there's no need to feed, and it's not necessarily that he needs to on Yom Kippur. By the way, want to talk about a complicated Yom Kippur scenario in a hospital where there are family members who are tending towards Rabbi Hanina's side and family members tending towards Rebbe's side who really want to make an argument about what should be with the feeding and the nourishment during the day of Yom Kippur? These are real hospital questions that chaplains have had to help people through in order to really think about how family life and dynamics work. V'af al gav d'amar Rav Safra, and the Mishnah teaches that although Rav Safra said, trei kameya umeya katrei, the principle that two people are as 100 and 100 are as two, hani mile le'inyan edut, pertains to witnesses. Don't worry about it here. Aval le'inyan umdana, but with regard to assessments in this kind of framework of life, batar deot azalinon, we follow the majority opinion. Mile le'inyan umdana de mamona, this statement of Rav Safra is that we follow the majority pertains, wait a minute, only to monetary assessments. So aval hacha tzvik nefeshodu, but here in our Mishnah it's a matter of uncertainty involving life and death. So in this case we follow whichever opinion is the lenient one, getting them to feed the guy.
Before, it said we follow the one with the greater expertise. It's interesting. But this is contradicts the previous criteria.
The first note says that there are two of them and they're listening to the one with the mole.
So
do you think that it undermines it entirely, or do you think that it could just be stating that in a meeting of the minds, two doctors here and two doctors here?
So I'll give you my what I tell all of my patients who say they want a second opinion. And I say, that's great, but you should now understand when you do this that you will become the doctor.
Mm.
Because the likelihood that these two opinions are going to be identical is pretty close to zero.
Really?
Yes. When we get into the kind of complex cases where we're talking about,
so it's very complex.
Where there are many different alternative ways to think what should be the next step when you've reached, an impasse.
Yeah,
okay.
So are you suggesting that the Bayesian model is before its time as well? That you need three dionemes?
I'm just saying.
So you need three doctors?
If the minute you get more than one opinion, you're going
to
become the doctor because you're going to be choosing one of them.
No,
the
but listen to where this Gemara could be going in that reality that you're recognizing now and stating could be the case. Maybe what happened here was that since the guy really can't be the doctor, they thought that the solution was to run out and get two new experts.
Or a hundred.
And those two who disagreed with these two create such a dilemma in the mind that maybe the guy is left, quote-unquote, to be the doctor. But let's just see where this part comes out, right? Hold that thought for a minute, because I was only half-joking about, why didn't they think of having a third doctor, and the third doctor will be the deciding doctor based on these two other doctors selling their cases. Now we have four here, it seems. But how could, let's just keep reading and see where it all kind of takes us. Midikatane seifa, but since the latter part of the Mishnah states, ve'im ein sham biki'in machilino to'al pi'atmo, and if there are no experts present, we feed him according to his own assessment, which is going to get to what you're saying, I think, to the patient. Michlal dereisha de'amar tzarich, this implies that the earlier part of the Mishnah, which requires experts to allow him to eat, also refers to a case where the sixth person says that he needs to eat. The Gemara answers by reinterpreting the Mishnah, chasuve me'achatra v'hache katani, it is as if the Mishnah is missing words, and this is how it really should read. In what case does this ruling apply, namely that experts are required to allow him to eat? The Amar lo tzarichani, when he says, I don't need it. Aval. Amar tzarichani, but where he said, I do need to eat, ein sham biki'in trei. If there are not two experts present, elechad de Amar lo tzarich, but one that says he doesn't need to. Remember, he says now what? I do need, but now there's one that says he doesn't. Machilino to al piatmo. He becomes the doctor. So, in that sense, what you may be observing is completely right, that the Gemara at least feels that he's going to have to make some kind of personal decision in the matter. Here in the case, though, it's only about having the where the one disagrees with him when he said, I need to eat, and you're saying that if he goes out and gets the second opinion, it's going to make him the one who has to decide.
Well, we know you need two witnesses, right? So there's a tradition here. It's a judicial tradition of being very skeptical about a single opinion.
Yeah, well, that's for sure part and parcel of this way of thinking.
They don't make an exception for the doctors.
Wait, but one could say about your sense that you're telling the person that he's going to become the doctor,
right,
that's a little bit skeptical about a second opinion. Is that
what you're
saying?
No, it's not skeptical. It's just that after they get the second opinion, which is different, then they come back to me and say, now which opinion should I take?
Should I take yours or the other guy?
So
does that make you, can I just ask in a kind of doctor-patient relationship kind of way, does that now make you a better physician because you're going to explain really why you believe your approach?
Primary doctor. You have to realize that
I'm talking about in general.
No, so I mean, obviously, I mean, the practical reality is we have a discussion about the logic that each doctor has presented for coming to their conclusion, right? I mean, they can come to two different conclusions but agree on the principles,
mm-hmm.
and it may be that the logic of one line is
mm-hmm.
much more compelling, or it may be that one chooses to ignore certain data
mm-hmm.
and emphasize other data, and
in
others
the opinion
choose
of
to ignore the other data and emphasize
no,
the other data. But essentially, it puts the patient in the leaving me aside because I'm just the fly on the wall. But it makes the patient put in the position of having to choose between two opinions.
That's
and the minute that happens, some people are very comfortable with that, and other people it drives them totally crazy.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just warn them that before they get the second opinion, they really have to understand what happens downstream with each of the potential realities.
Mm.
And some people, it's very, very difficult for them. They really, especially if they don't feel well in the first place. And
yeah, it will cause more stress than it's worth.
And it creates, it can create enormous. And then you have the possibility, depending upon family members, that family members may disagree as to which doctor the
right.
family
well,
may follow.
That, I feel,
so now,
is inherent
yeah.
within some of this text as well. That's
and
when he was standing around.
In the
yeah.
family, you know, supporting this doctor's
for sure.
recommendations and supporting that doctor's.
For
the
sure.
poor sick person is now sitting there, you know, totally paralyzed
yeah.
by having not only the doctor's opinions,
yeah.
but the overlay of the
right.
psychodynamics of the complex family.
Meanwhile, the Mishnah is interpreted to encourage the assessment of an individual on Yom Kippur who says, I need to eat. And they come up with some way to engage in the people they think are most experts in that regard to make some assessments. And they do indeed have the person expressing that they feel the need to eat, not just the desire, not just my appetite's back, I could eat. But he says, I need to eat. And I think that getting outside of the true kind of medical framework here for a moment, what we see here is some openness to answering this question of the 24 or 25 hour thing. Can he really be without it? And if someone really is claiming that I can't be without it, then we allow for it to happen within the context of a ritual of Yom Kippur.
Let me give you a more theological interpretation. I think, remember, we're talking about God's creation, right? God's creation includes having a sense of hunger. That's part of God's creation.
Right.
And if God's creation says, I need to eat,
bless you.
To some extent, to interfere with that decision is to interfere with God's decision, because that was what was built into that
right.
person.
Well, it for sure goes back to the part of the Gemara that was about the ethical decisions that made an inferential reference to the chayvahem. You should live through them. You should really live through these mitzvot. And Yom Kippur can't become a day that, quote unquote, you're plotting. You can't give up your life to celebrate all you need to fulfill the words of Torah when it comes to la'anot et nashotechem, to afflict your souls. So we're going to leave it at that and get to this book the next time, plus the next Mishnah the next time, because that's going to get us into all kinds of good conversations about life and disease and more and more medical.
I just wanted to
know a conflict, you know.
What is that book called
again? What's the conflict?
Well, it's a saint's day, I know, but there are people who are very romantic.
Oh, next week? Come on a date here. What are you talking about?